Welcome to NEPR News Now. I'm Sam Hudzik. Now, a special episode focusing on a single plant.
Marijuana.
Weed.
Cannabis.
Marijuana.
Pot.
Cannabis.
Marijuana.
Well, whatever you call it, Massachusetts is on a slow march to full legalization. Possession for recreational use has been legal since September 2016, but no one has been licensed by the state to sell it. And a July 1st goal to get a marijuana store open came and went. Even when retail sales do begin, New England Public Radio's Nancy Cohen reports the illegal market isn't expected to go away anytime soon.
The big day arrived, but not a whole lot changed.
There's just not enough dispensaries, there's not enough cultivators, there's not enough manufacturers legally.
That's Kamani Jefferson, president of the Massachusetts Recreational Consumer Council, which advocates for cannabis consumers. Jefferson says unlike the medical market, the new recreational sales will be taxed by as much as 20%.
The illicit market will have the upper hand with just not having a tax.
So for now, the illegal sales aren't about to stop.
I obtain it, I pay for it, and then I turn around and charge people and then pay my creditors back.
A 71-year-old builder earns his living renovating houses. He also distributes marijuana without trying to make much money from it.
I expect people to pay, you know, what I pay and a very, very, very small fee beyond that.
He doesn't want his name used because what he does is illegal. He first used marijuana in 1970 as a U.S. soldier in Vietnam.
I think it served me by giving me probably the best attitude to get through that situation. So I love life. I just love life a little bit more with marijuana.
He also loves helping others get marijuana at a decent price. As cannabis becomes legal in Massachusetts, the experiences of people who left the black market in Colorado may offer some lessons here. Luke Ramirez says he made $5,000 to $10,000 a month selling pot in Colorado before it was legal.
We're certainly not talking Al Capone or organized cartel type of money, just your classic medium-sized cannabis dealer.
Ramirez says he got tired of watching out for the police, so he opened his first legal cannabis business, a medical dispensary, in 2009 when Colorado regulations were pretty loose. It's a good thing he did. Within a few years, the street price for marijuana dropped dramatically.
I'd say that's the point of having legal marijuana, is that you price the black market out. So the dealers have less of a market here, and they're forced to go to other states, or they're forced to quit, or they're forced to join the legal side of the cannabis industry.
But joining the legal side now in Colorado and in Massachusetts can be costly and complex. A 40-year-old Iraqi war veteran who doesn't want his name used because of the stigma of being a cannabis advocate says opening a pot store should be as easy as a dry cleaner's or a liquor store. And he says he doesn't want his community left out.
A lot of people like myself will absolutely not participate in any type of new scheme that doesn't take into consideration the very real racial history of cannabis prohibition and what the drug war has done to our neighborhoods.
And those neighborhoods, he says, should be first in line for legal cannabis stores and the economic benefits they could bring. State regulators insist they take those concerns seriously. Cannabis Control Commissioner Charlene Title.
It's our obligation both under the law and morally to make sure that the people who have bore the brunt of prohibition all of this time now have a fair shot to enter this business.
The commission says it will give priority consideration to applicants who meet several criteria, such as being a person of color, having a drug-related criminal record, or living in communities hit hard by drug enforcement. And regulators just announced a new training program.
The point of the equity program is to provide technical assistance and allow full participation by the people from these disproportionately harmed communities.
Sean Birdie, a former Boston firefighter who did time for cultivating pot, plans to apply for the program. He wants to learn about accounting, legal compliance, and investors.
I hope to get a retail license, but I don't foresee that happening just because of the financial hardships that prison has cost me.
Bertie estimates the cost of starting a recreational business ranges from $2 to $5 million. Others say it could be as low as $1 million. And under federal law, banks can't loan money to a marijuana business. Michael Ortol of Braintree says he's working on lining up investors. He was incarcerated for a year and a half for felony possession of marijuana. As a Latino with a drug record, he qualifies for priority consideration from the Cannabis Commission.
I don't see any other reason to be in the illegal market if they're offering this way up. So it's up to somebody to go and grab it, in my opinion, and that's what I'm doing.
But not everybody's embracing the legal market. Black market cannabis is still king. That's because, like any business, it's about convenience and price. Many towns have pushed back against legal marijuana, both medical and recreational. A 56-year-old housewife from Franklin County, a medical user, says she has visited a medical marijuana dispensary, but it's a bit of a ride, had long lines, and...
When the dispensaries opened, they were slightly more expensive than black market weed. Pretty quickly, black market weed became less expensive.
A few years ago, an ounce of high-quality cannabis on the street went for $300 to $400. Now it's down to $250 or even $150. Some believe that's because the overall supply has grown, either from people growing their own, Massachusetts medical dispensaries, or illegal shipments coming in from Western states. Prices at medical dispensaries have dropped, but at $300 to $350 an ounce, they still exceed the street price. With no retail stores open, many are sticking with the unregulated market, including at times the Franklin County housewife, for several reasons.
Quality, human connection, provenance, I know where it comes from, price. I think it's a really Yankee part of me that likes to do business over a handshake.
But that loyalty is going to be tested if what happened to marijuana prices in other states happens here. In its first 2 years, the legal retail price in Washington state dropped by nearly two-thirds. If in time the legal price shifts in Massachusetts, the 71-year-old builder says he will too.
If the prices are equal to or slightly above my prices, I would have no reason to ever, ever, ever participate in sales. There would be no need.
That's a long ways off. No one is even certain when the first retail marijuana store will open in Massachusetts. For New England Public Radio, I'm Nancy Cohen.
Just because it's legal to smoke marijuana in Massachusetts doesn't mean everyone will start lighting up, if they haven't already. But legalization will change many people's access to the drug and how they think about its pros and cons. New England Public Radio's Karen Brown has that story.
So here I am, 51 years old, at a Dead show. For the uninitiated, that's a few original members of the iconic 60s band, The Grateful Dead, plus a few other musicians. The last time I was among this much tie-dye was in the 80s, when I was a college student following the Dead around the Bay Area. And I will admit, because I'm pretty sure there's a statute of limitations, I was not unfamiliar with the pungent haze wafting through the lawn seats, nor the baked goods being offered by a few ragged entrepreneurs.
Edible brownies. I just want to get rid of these last 10 brownies I have. What's in it? 100 milligrams of blue green.
Marijuana has been off my radar for decades. For one, other than post-hippie gatherings like this, I wouldn't know where to get it. And two, it's been against the law. Robin Fordham is a friend of mine who, like me, hasn't smoked pot in years.
I saw it as something that just carried the stigma. You were doing something that was illegal and therefore threatening to your kids and your family, and so it was just easier to stay away from.
But things are about to change, at least in Massachusetts. In 2016, voters decided to legalize recreational weed. The state is now days away from allowing retail sales, and the question of whether to partake is back on many people's minds.
I just remember being really happy.
Tom is a 49-year-old Northampton dad who smoked a lot of weed in college.
So if I can do some acceptable thing that reaches that level of happiness, that's great.
Tom asked me not to use his last name because, as a consultant in the jewelry business, he works in states where cannabis is not legal. But he has good memories from his dope days.
To me, it was utter relaxation. Whatever stress or worries I had disappeared, and everything was hilarious.
but he started to think it was affecting his memory and motivation. And after college, he worried employers might require drug tests. Plus, he doesn't like breaking the law.
That's a major motivator for me, is to not get in trouble.
So he gave up pot, got married, had two children, built a business.
It never really tempted me, even. And not until they started talking about legalization. I was like, oh, that's interesting. You know, so then it would no longer be against the rules.
My friend Robin shares Tom's feelings about legalization, if not the same nostalgia about smoking pot in her youth.
Mostly it just made me tired and made me want to eat a lot. But the fact that it's become more legal has made it more appealing in terms of curiosity. It's like, oh, why not?
I spoke to several people, like Tom and Robin, who are reconsidering a habit they abandoned years ago. Most wouldn't talk on tape because they worried there's still a stigma. Some told me they don't really crave the high anymore, and some wondered, is it even good for them?
You have to put it in perspective. Is it a completely safe compound? No. Is it safer than other compounds that are available? Yes.
Sean Hennessy is an epidemiologist who worked on a national report on the health effects of marijuana. He says the researchers reviewed 100 studies on cannabis and concluded the risks are relatively low, especially compared to alcohol.
For example, it's difficult to consume enough cannabis to kill yourself acutely, whereas it's fairly easy to drink enough alcohol to kill yourself.
But there are some health issues. For instance, Tom worries about damaging his lungs from smoking. Hennessy says smoking cannabis can bring on respiratory symptoms.
And stopping smoking cannabis has a tendency to make those respiratory symptoms go away.
Unlike with tobacco, the report did not find a higher risk of lung cancer or heart problems from smoking marijuana. And Hennessy points out you can avoid inhaling cannabis by consuming it in lollipops or brownies, but be careful how much you eat.
There are these stories of people who go to Colorado for a pot vacation and take more edibles than they should and get put on a couch for a number of hours.
On the mental health side, researchers found a correlation between schizophrenia and pot use, though it's possible people with schizophrenia are simply more likely to use cannabis. The evidence suggests symptoms of other mental illnesses, like bipolar disorder, can get worse. Hennessy says cannabis could help reduce opioid abuse if people choose the less addictive marijuana instead. And he says there's little evidence cannabis is a gateway to more dangerous drugs, like heroin.
And if anything, that might become less as cannabis becomes less criminalized.
That's because, for some people, breaking the rules is an allure in itself. Tom doesn't think he'd be tempted to try harder drugs. He's more worried that by using cannabis openly, his teenage children would be more likely to try it. And there is evidence that marijuana can harm the developing brain. Plus, getting stoned can make you lazy.
Just made it so easy to put things off that should have gotten done. And I don't want to model behavior that I don't want them to do.
Then there's the question of potency, especially for people who haven't consumed marijuana in a long time. Hennessy recommends starting slow.
People's physiology may have changed, and the weed that they're going to buy at the dispensary now is probably a lot stronger than the weed that they were smoking 20 years ago.
That's why Tom is comforted to think cannabis will be regulated and sold in stores.
I kind of get the impression that the people in the stores are going to be relatively knowledgeable, and they're probably going to have a lot of 50-year-olds go in with similar stories. So I hope that, you know, they wouldn't give me anything that's beyond what I could handle.
Robin doesn't expect to become a habitual user. She's just looking for an alternative to the occasional after-dinner drink.
Instead of a glass of wine, what would that be like? You know, is it good for anxiety? Is it, who knows, you know? But now it just doesn't feel verboten. You know, it doesn't feel scary.
Of course, many people have been getting high for years. At the recent Dead show, recreational marijuana was not actually legal. The concert was in Connecticut, just over the Massachusetts border. But medical marijuana is allowed there, and judging by the ubiquitous haze and aroma, a large number of prescriptions were written for the occasion. For New England Public Radio, I'm Karen Brown.
So in that story, Tom and Robin were considering letting a little marijuana back into their lives. But a survey released in June of Massachusetts residents found more than a fifth of adults say they'd used marijuana in the past 30 days. The study was commissioned by the Massachusetts legislature to help gauge the eventual impact of marijuana legalization in the state. New England Public Radio's Adam Frenier spoke with Jennifer Whitehill, a UMass Amherst professor who helped author the study. He asked Whitehill what the research can tell us about how marijuana is perceived in Massachusetts.
Around 50% of adults really see little or no risk with marijuana. And that's not only the users who responded, but was reflective of the whole population.
And in this study, there were a number of young people that were asked about this. What can you tell us about that 18 to 25-year-old range?
A big takeaway from this is that it is younger age ranges who tended to have a higher prevalence rate of using marijuana compared to older age groups.
And how are they using it? How are they ingesting it?
What I guess at this point would be considered old-fashioned smoking remains the most common way to use marijuana, but a sizable proportion of the users in the study, I think it was a little over 40%, they also use it in other ways, which included things like edible products and vaporizing.
The study also looked at people who use marijuana and then shortly thereafter drive a vehicle. What can you tell us about that?
Because the survey was weighted for the population, we can talk about estimates for two different groups. We can talk about the general population of Massachusetts, and we can also talk about marijuana users. And so we found that about 7% of adults, all adults in Massachusetts, reported driving under the influence of marijuana in the past 30 days. When we limit that and look only at the marijuana users, those numbers ranged as high as about 35%.
Is there any correlation between marijuana use and car accidents?
That's a great question. In the public health field and the epidemiology to date, there are a lot of challenges trying to pin a specific number down for the risk of a car crash due to marijuana. And numbers that you hear when I talk about this, I say something in between probably a 20% increase in risk and maybe a doubling of risk. We also hear that. That is work that is existing epidemiological research that did not come from this baseline study. That said, in this study, they did want us to look at how you might be able to detect marijuana in drivers, and we looked into what the literature says about available devices for testing for this. We really find that although there are ways to measure marijuana use in blood or in the oral fluid, actually, of drivers, that is not correlated with impairment. And that's a really critical thing to be able to say someone used, but what was the time window for that use? We can't say that only from a level the way we can with alcohol. And we also can't know whether a level that you might measure in someone's oral fluid, for example, was correlated with impairment at the time of driving.
That was Jennifer Whitehill, a professor at UMass Amherst, who helped conduct a new statewide study of marijuana use in Massachusetts. It's probably a given that you shouldn't smoke up and then fire a gun. But the federal government is sending a message that if you want to own a gun, you can't ever use marijuana. That story from New England Public Radio's Alden Bourne.
In late June, a gun store in Charlemont, Massachusetts, posted a letter on Facebook from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. The letter from 2011 notified gun dealers that just because someone has a state medical marijuana card, it doesn't mean it's legal for them to purchase a gun.
We've had several people come into the store.
Charles Rico owns Overwatch Outpost Outfitters.
They haven't purchased guns, but people have made statements such as, you know, well, I'm a medical marijuana card holder and that marijuana is legal in Massachusetts now, so it shouldn't affect them with buying a gun.
But it does. To buy a firearm, a person first has to fill out a form. It asks a series of questions, like whether they've ever been convicted of a felony, been committed to a mental institution, or are an unlawful user of marijuana. And in the federal government's eyes, any use of marijuana is unlawful. Matthew O'Shaughnessy is with the ATF's Boston office.
Certain states have legalized the use of marijuana, and ATF wanted to let federal firearms licensees know, remind them that it's still illegal federally to use marijuana.
So in 2016, the ATF decided to add some bold print to that questionnaire, now warning that pot remains illegal under federal law. State law doesn't matter. Maggie Kinsella works for the Massachusetts Cannabis Reform Coalition. She says the group doesn't have a position on this, but personally, she sees the limitation as unfair.
There's no restriction on alcohol consumption and gun rights, so this is just one more thing they're trying to do to blockade cannabis consumers and put them into a lower class of citizenship. It's not right.
But unless Congress changes the law, the ATF will keep enforcing it. The Bureau's Matthew O'Shaughnessy says the marijuana question isn't something to be trifled with.
If you answer falsely on this question here in question E, if you answer no and you actually are, you're subject to a felony charge for lying on a federal form.
But O'Shaughnessy says no one has been arrested in Massachusetts for answering the question falsely. For New England Public Radio, I'm Alden Bourne.
Massachusetts may be facing these questions and complications around legalized marijuana for the first time. But the Bay State is hardly the first to go down this road. New England Public Radio's Carrie Healy chatted with a pair of reporters from states that have long since legalized cannabis.
We turn now to Ben Marcus at Colorado Public Radio. And in Washington at Public Radio KNKX, Gabriel Spitzer. Thanks to both of you for joining me.
Good morning.
Thanks for having us.
Let's start with the economics of marijuana. Gabriel, since adult-use marijuana in Washington was legalized, have medical marijuana dispensaries continued to stay in business?
They have not. That was sort of part of the ultimate end goal of the legalization of recreational marijuana here in Washington, was to eventually fold the medical marijuana system, which was sort of lightly regulated, considered kind of a gray market here, into the legalized system. So actually, there's no longer any officially recognized medical dispensaries here. There's a kind of special designation that certain recreational stores can get, and patients are entitled to forgo sales tax, which is really only a small part of the taxes that are collected on pot sales here. But essentially, the medical stores, which used to be ubiquitous here in Seattle, in fact, have all but dried up now.
What did the economics of marijuana mean has happened in Colorado, Ben?
Well, we do still have many medical stores here in Colorado, and that's in part because of taxes, actually. The tax rate on medical is much lower than it is for recreational. So that market has stayed alive. So if you walk into a store in Colorado, you'll see two counters. One counter is for medical patients. The other counter is for recreational. If you went into Denver, you wanted to look at the economics of marijuana, you would just see that there are 200 stores in one city. It's kind of like gas stations, right? They're on every corner. And the economics of that means it's driven the price down. It's made profitability much harder in Colorado. It's good for the consumer. It's a lot more difficult for the businesses, especially with the tax limitations they have and the kind of deductions they can take because it's federally illegal. So good for the consumer, bad for the business, good for tax revenue. State's collecting about $200 million a year now in tax revenue, which isn't breaking the bank in terms of state budgets, but it's definitely revenue they didn't have before.
Gabe, what does the state tax revenue look like for Washington?
It's a bit lower than in Colorado. We don't have quite as many stores, and I think the overall sales volume is a bit less than in Colorado. But the other thing about taxes here in Washington is that almost all of the tax revenue is earmarked, much of it for public health and drug prevention and education services, as a matter of fact. Not very much of it is going to the state's general fund. So it's not like it's all of a sudden, paying for schools or that kind of thing. Only a small portion of it is going into discretionary spending. The rest really is earmarked specifically to offset and deal with some of the, what was anticipated to be the social effects of legalizing recreational marijuana here.
Has there been a big effect on the black market now that sales are legal?
It's mixed, and it depends what indicators you're looking at. On the one hand, if you think about one of the purposes of legalizing recreational marijuana here, it was to stop criminalizing the black market, at least for users and small sellers. And in that sense, it's been a big impact. There are very, very few people now going to jail and getting arrested and even getting ticketed for marijuana possession and sales, with the exception of, you know, large scale traffickers and so on. But on the other hand, there's still plenty of black market weed out there, and the prices fluctuate a fair amount. So the recreational market has had a bit of a hard time competing with the black market in terms of trying to keep its prices low enough so people buy from the stores rather than somebody on the street.
And Ben, is black market pot still a thing in Colorado?
It is, but the nature of the black market has shifted. So now the black market in Colorado is one that supplies marijuana to the rest of the country and surrounding states. What we have going on with some cases is something called looping, where people come from out of state and they buy the maximum amount of marijuana per transaction at multiple stores or the same store, and then they drive that marijuana back to their home state. It's not exactly clear how widespread that is. The other black market is for youth. So marijuana possession is legal in Colorado now, up to an ounce. But if you're under the age of 21, it is not. And so arrests of people who are under the age of 21 are still quite high. And it tends to target Hispanics and blacks, according to the latest state data, disproportionately, just as it did before legalization.
Ben, in Massachusetts, there are lots of communities who have voted for a moratorium on sales, and have used zoning laws to keep marijuana out. Is that the case way back for Colorado?
Yeah, so just to draw a distinction, so there, Denver has 200 marijuana stores, recreational marijuana stores. The city of Colorado Springs, an hour south of here, has zero. So each community gets to choose exactly how they want to design their system. Communities, local communities, have a lot of control. Now, Colorado Springs still has a lot of medical stores, so their medical patient numbers are quite high. And the argument among advocates is, by not allowing recreational sales within your city, you're simply pushing the sales to other counties that get to benefit from the higher tax revenue that comes from recreational marijuana. But it's, Colorado Springs is a conservative community with multiple military bases, and so they're making a decision that fits their community.
You know, we're all reporters here, all in the business of communicating. What the heck are you all calling marijuana in your news coverage? We found that we can alternate it with marijuana and pot, but what have your stations been doing?
Yeah, so when we first passed legalization, we were using interchangeably using pot, weed, marijuana, but marijuana more frequently. We started to get complaints from marijuana businesses who felt like cannabis was a more appropriate term. Now, cannabis is more of a European type of term for marijuana. So now we use marijuana and cannabis interchangeably primarily. We don't use pot or weed because that's seen as more of a kind of lower level use of the term.
Ben in Colorado, thanks. So then, and Gabriel in Washington, what are you calling it?
Pretty similar, actually. Particularly at the beginning, there was a lot of nudging to use cannabis as a kind of more neutral term, a less loaded sounding term. But we typically use marijuana and cannabis interchangeably, and we still do call it pot and weed occasionally as well, just because that's what people call it, including a lot of the businesses, a lot of the stores. A lot of the signs say legal weed on them, so it's a little bit hard to avoid that.
Anecdotally, have either of you seen junk food sales, fast food sales go up in your state?
I wouldn't know, I guess. Sorry.
I mean, part of the problem in Seattle and Denver is that the population growth is so fast that, yes, restaurant sales have hit record levels in Denver, but that may just be because we're importing tons of people.
I will say this, shortly after the legalization, there's an annual event that predates the legalization here called HempFest. And that year, the Seattle Police Department attended HempFest with informational stickers that explain the new law stuck to bags of Doritos. And they handed out these bags of Doritos at HempFest. They called it Operation Orange Fingers.
Nice. I think that goes to that stigma you were talking about, though, right? When Colorado passed its marijuana law, the governor said, don't break out the goldfish and the Cheetos just yet, referring to what would the federal government do. But just that idea that, you know, that people have preconceived notions about what a typical user looks like, and that may not actually be the case, but it's our popular culture that has kind of painted people in a certain light.
That was Ben Marcus from Colorado Public Radio and Gabriel Spitzer from KNKX in Seattle, speaking with New England Public Radio's Carrie Healy. thanks so much for joining us for this special marijuana, pot, cannabis, weed edition of NEPR News Now. For much more news from New England Public Radio, head on over to NEPR.net. We also have a great selection of podcasts to choose from, including Beacon Hill and 5, where host Carrie Healy talks to State House reporter Matt Murphy for a quick look at the week ahead in politics and government in Massachusetts. And remember, New England Public Radio is a listener-supported public media company, so all of this is made possible by contributions from you and other members of our community. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time.